All right, welcome to the latest edition of Scribe Session. I am your Bengals beat writer, Paul Daner Jr. Today, we have gone, I said we're going to span the globe while we're in our little small nugget of space before we have our next beat writer here. So I'm moving out of the state of Ohio, and I'm going to beautiful Wisconsin, because that's where you go. I'm here with Jake Lisco from Pro Football Focus, who is the Bengals. Part of his job is the Bengals, correspondent. Is that fair, Jake?
I think that's fair. Media liaison correspondent, sure.
Ooh, liaison. That's got to be feel good to have liaison in your title.
Yeah, it's a fancy word.
Yeah. Well, he compiles all of the advanced statistics that Pro Football Focus uses from Cincinnati area, has a great feel for the team, and when you spend days and days pouring over tape of the same team and every player and analyzing every movement, you get a pretty good feel, I'd imagine, for exactly what is happening with the Bengals. How many hours, Jake, would you say that you spend during the course of a season just watching tape of Bengals games?
Well, the Bengals games get a little bit more of my attention than the other games that I work on. So the typical game probably takes me from 8 to 10 hours to get through on the first pass, and with the Bengals games, I'll spend a little bit more time just looking for interesting plays and stuff that I want to write about personally. So probably in the range of 12-ish to 15 hours per Bengals game, with a lot of that time spent on the TV angles until we get access to the coaches' film on Tuesdays, which everybody else has access to, obviously, as well, if they're an NFL Game Rewind subscriber. So yeah, 15 hours and you got 16 games, and so probably over 300 hours there without getting too fancy with math.
Oh, it sounds a bit depressing, honestly, but you love it probably.
When it's the Bengals, I certainly do. I can really get into it when it's the Bengals and when I'm watching the coach's tape to figure out what happened on my own. Some of the games are rough, like the San Diego game that was tough, and some of the losses, you can't take fandom out of it when you've been a fan as long as I have anyway. So, you know, the first Browns loss, well, the Browns loss, I guess, it didn't been great. The losses in general, they're just not fun to watch.
Yeah, it's wild. And I guess to do this for me, because I think people, this is what I want to kind of get into, why I wanted to have you on, is because we've seen advanced metrics and analytics start to really seep heavily into the sports world. That culture, I think, most prominently brought on in baseball, where you've seen all the saber metrics has really taken, when some of the purists have started to sort of adopt them. Pro Football Focus, I think, has really been the leader in trying to take that same concept and apply it to football. Football is so much harder because there's so many different working pieces, the team element. There's not as much one-on-one where you have that even playing field that everybody's on. There's different schemes, different positions, different, you know, ways that you're used. Everybody plays off each other, so it's harder to judge individual performance. But you guys do your best, I guess. Take me through how you guys do what you do, because you come up, the grades and the amount of content on the site is ridiculous. I mean, you really have specific breakdowns for team, game, situation, player, and just about any aspect imaginable. How do you come up with it? Take me through like the basic of trying to create grades for every player, every play, every team, and how it ends up looking as it does at the end of the day.
Sure. Well, you know, Steve Palazzolo back in September wrote a great little piece on Pro Football Focus about grades, stats, and analytics and the future thereof, and Pro Football Focus is in that scene, which I recommend anybody who's interested in analytics read to kind of get a feel for what it is PFF is all about. But our process is very extensive, to say the least. We have at least two passes. Actually, we have more than two passes now per phase or sorry, we have two passes-ish, two plus passes per phase. There are multiple phases of what goes into evaluating a single game. So we'll start with what we call player participation, and this is where everyone at Pro Football Focus starts. Everyone who works for Pro Football Focus starts by doing player participation. Player participation is logging for every single play, who's on the field, where they lined up on the field, with very specific annotation and a general documentation of what they've done on the play.
Yeah.
That goes through two passes and gets QA'd for a third pass as well. So we've got that first step establishes, you know, your snap counts and what everyone's doing on every play. So if you've got a guy who gets on the field for one play and he does something great, how do you value that versus a player who plays, you know, an average game but plays 70 snaps? So that's where the snap counts are important, is allowing the weighting for playing time to factor into the grading equation.
Sure.
As far as grades, that again goes through several passes. I didn't do the grades myself last year. I don't think that anyone in their first year of Pro Football Focus goes right into the grades. It's something that people work up to as they learn more. And I did learn a ton from watching that much tape of football games in my first year with Pro Football Focus. But I can tell you that it goes through several steps. Every play gets a look from multiple angles. There's a lot of documentation that goes on behind the scenes, too, that's not even available to our premium statistics subscribers. And the interesting thing is, you know, I think a lot of people take a look at our ranking lists and they say, you know, A.J. Green should be a top three receiver, but he ranked, you know, he wasn't in the top three for wide receivers last year. In fact, he only ranked, I can't even count that high. There we go, 17th. An overall receiving grade last year among receivers. Of course, that takes into account his run blocking grade, but you know, if you look at his only his receiving game, even then he's 14th behind Marvin Jones. And Marvin Jones obviously had a career year for himself last year. But you ask yourself, on every single play of every game, did A.J. Green really have a top three season, even as a receiver? He dropped 14 pass fumbles, and when you factor in that sort of negative side of the game that often isn't captured by a traditional stat line, you start to get a clearer picture as to why A.J. Green was a top 15 guy and not a top 3 guy last year. Similarly, Josh Gordon, who played only 14 games and still led the league in receiving, was 15th in receiving, in his receiving grade last year. So it doesn't always line up with what fans are expecting and with what the names suggest for certain players, and I think that's where we get a lot of pushback. But it's interesting because I felt the same way before I joined Pro Football Focus, and now that I'm a part of that organization, I get to see how each play is graded, and I can watch the tape that goes with that play. And I haven't found more than just a couple instances where I really questioned the grade, and in a couple of those instances, I talked to a guy, and he convinced me that the grade that was assigned made sense. So The question of how grades and stats and analytics all fit together is really interesting to us. We are a little bit different from Sabermetrics in that we don't try to quantify, you know, we admit that stats have faults, and so does Sabermetrics, and we don't try to necessarily aspire to something that equates to wins over replacement or, you know, weighted on base average as you have in baseball that really distills all of one side of the game into one number that assigns player value.
Yeah.
We have some with grading, but we recognize that stats can't get there. Any stat taken in a vacuum is going to have issues. You're going to be able to tell any story you want with any single statistic, or you find a stat that makes your story make sense. That's why we like the grades, because that takes all of that into account, fills into a number that we think is as close to that wins above replacement that you can get. Similarly, you know, another analytics site is Football Outsiders, and they take a different approach that I can't speak to, but there are a few guys out there and Advanced Football Stats that have tried to take different tacks to figuring out the numbers game of football.
It's really interesting what we're starting to see now, that I found a really interesting headline from about a month ago was Tampa Bay Buccaneers hired an advanced stats and analytics position. They're really sort of investing in that concept and embracing it. And if you look at some of their fact that they signed Michael Johnson, despite the old school stat people saying he only had 3.5 sacks, and if they signed Anthony Collins, despite that he only started as many games he did, knowing that Michael Johnson's pressures were up because of the advanced stat, had your guys' award for most efficient pass blocker in football last year as far as on a per-play basis. Probably no coincidence that those go together, and you're starting to see that. I mean, do you see that? And I know you guys as an organization probably talk, I mean, you're not up on the highest of levels there, but you see it specifically with conversations you have with people from the Bengals. Are you starting to see that where you guys as an organization is noticing how teams are adopting this now and really embracing it more, whereas in the past it was always just, oh, those guys don't know what they're talking about. They don't know, only the people watching the tape know what the player was supposed to be doing or what have you. But it seems like the pendulum is starting to swing back the other way a little bit, because I know Pro Football Focus is working with a ton of NFL teams now too.
Sure. Yeah, I think that over time we've seen that acceptance has increased. And it's like any other new stat that has come into a sport, going to meet its share of resistance and take some time to really get into the roots and get into how teams operate. You make an interesting point with Michael Johnson and Anthony Collins, two guys that, you're right, by the traditional stats, don't necessarily jump off the sheet at you, but if you look at their film, you see, like you said, a very efficient pass blocker in Anthony Collins, who didn't give up a sack last year on 673 snaps. Like you said, he was our quote-unquote most efficient pass blocker, and that uses, of course, our pass blocking efficiency metric. Now, the 389 pass blocking snaps, so the only issue there with Collins is he didn't have a bunch of playing time last year, right? So you kind of wonder, can he do it over a full season? And he did it in stretches. He played a ton of snaps from week 13 through the playoffs, so it seemed that he can do it over at least that period of time, but that's the question facing the Buccaneers there now. Michael Johnson is an interesting case as well. While he did log more total pressures last year, his overall pass rushing productivity was actually slightly down, insignificantly so, but slightly down compared to the year before because he played more snaps.
Right.
He ended with 61 total pressures on the year, but he had, the fifth most pass rushes in football at 553. And that's a similar principle applies with Jared Allen, who had 13 sacks and had kind of a hard time finding a home, despite that 13 sack number. And I think that's because teams are seeing, hey, he had the most pass rushes in the league last year, 4-3 defensive end, so he had plenty of shots to get there, and there are guys that did more with less, which, when you think about it, makes Robert Quinn's season even more impressive because he had 150 less snaps, almost 200 less snaps than did Allen, and came out with almost 30 more pressures and 6 more sacks.
Yeah, yeah. It's wild. We see sort of over free agency, you guys kind of came to the forefront how many times did the site crash during that week, the first week of free agency? I mean, I felt like every other time I'd go on there, it would be slow or have crashed for a little bit, and they'd get it back up because everyone was trying to learn about players from other teams, and you guys were the site that everyone seemed to be going to.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
I think we heard that was probably one of the best weeks for the site that we've ever had. That week of free agency. And it just speaks to the growing popularity of the advanced stats. And that's part of what one of our goals with the media program was to raise awareness. And you'd see, you and Joe Reedy throwing out PFF numbers in the pieces every week, and the more guys use that, the more the beat writers are using that data, the more that people are reading about it in the newspapers or hearing about it on the radio, or seeing about it on Twitter, it's been really a treat to see. And Neil, who's our founder, reiterates to us that, you know, you guys still are on the ground floor here. We're still taking off. We're at the beginning of that exponential growth curve, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that that's absolutely true. I think there's a lot left to do. It's like you said, it's a complicated game. 22 moving parts on the field at any given time. Well, most plays anyway. As long as you get all five of the offensive linemen getting off the ball. But, you know, it's come a long way. And I think we've got some exciting stuff coming up, too.
Yeah.
It's a time to be in football analytics, I think.
Yeah, it's certainly something with the as much time, money, and energy is funneled into the NFL, it's really only a matter of time until every team adopts even beyond their own video, utilizing it, because the more information, the better for all these teams, and that's why you're starting to see the connection. I mean, you know, for us, in a conversation that I've had, and I try to write this anytime I reference Well Focus, is that everybody has their own opinion. That's why there's so many different coaches, there's so many different styles, there's different scouts, because everybody has their own opinion on what they see, what they value, what they think is happening, because football is just so complex. That I always try to say this, you can't take every grade as the law, but it's a great jumping off point to look at and to deeper at certain things. You know, to look deeper at what Anthony Collins did, or to look deeper at the play of Michael Johnson and not see. In the old days, they'd look at 3.5 sacks and teams would look away. But I think now, or maybe it's just more of the fans and everyone else being led into what the coaches do, which is what you guys do, spend so much time pouring over the video. Regardless, it's great for the game. And it's great, I think, for everybody involved to have a better understanding of what's going on there. Do you have like a favorite stat? You have a stat that you love going to that you feel like is just one of the smartest, most, I don't know, new revolutionary ones that you just feel like just really hits a certain aspect of the game on the head?
There are a couple out there. I think pass rush productivity, like I said, does a great job of really distilling actually how productive a pass rusher is. For quarterbacks, I like our accuracy percentage number, which takes into account throwaways, drops, hit is thrown, spikes, and throws those out of the completion percentage formula, so you find out how many catchable passes did this guy throw. And then you have a number that represents how many balls he's putting out there that are catchable. I really like that one. And then the other one that I think is pretty cool, and I'm not exactly sure how to quantify this number yet, but I think we're going in that direction, is the elusive rating, which tells you, you know, it gives you a way to rank who's making the most guys miss. And we use that for running backs for the most part, but I've run the numbers myself for wide receivers too. So, you know, obviously you've got Adrian Peterson on top of the list this year, and you just get the baseline there, and you can see, all right, Ray Rice, well, wow, he only made 13 guys miss tackles last year on almost 270 touches or so. And then you look at Adrian Peterson, it's like, well, all right, so there's what we would expect from AP. He made, you know, 67, he broke 67 tackles on about 300 carries. So, and it also takes into account how many yards guys are getting after contact. So I think that's a good way to see what's a running back skill versus is he getting what's blocked? And the guys at the bottom of the list are more guys that are getting what's blocked and they're going down when they meet somebody. And the guys at the top are guys that can really create for themselves. So I think that's one of our interesting numbers too, even though the number itself, I still need, you know, it's good to get relative value, but it's tough to use in a vacuum.
Yeah. I mean, I guess people think of elusive rating, they probably think of Giovanni Bernard. How to kind of start to move a little bit over to some of the Bengals players. I mean, where did Gio end up in the elusive rating last year?
Gio did most of his work in the passing game. As a runner, he broke 24 tackles on 170 touches, and as a receiver, he broke 20 tackles on 56 touches, and I think like half of those came on one play. But that was not quite half, but you know what I'm talking about. With
yeah,
Theo.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
He ended up ranking 10th just ahead of Eddie Lacy in that category. Lacy, of course, broke all of his tackles by running through guys in the running. Meanwhile, you got Ben Jarvis Green-Ellis down at 29th with an elusive rating about half that of Gio Bernard. He broke 25 tackles all in the running game on 220 carries. And the more interesting number for me there is the yards after contact, where Ben Jarvis Green-Ellis was just under 2. And Gio Bernard was at 2.25. And you see elite guys in the league, Chris Ivory, Adrian Peterson, to some extent Alfred Morris, were the elite guys in getting yards after contact last year. Those guys were all around 3, with Alfred Morris being down at 2.7 yards after contact, along with DeMarco Murray, actually.
Yeah. Running backs are really interesting. It's probably the closest you can get to the sabermetric one-on-one baseball concept of pitcher versus batter is running back versus tackler. You know, I mean, you a lot of times you have multiple guys trying to take them down, but there's so many opportunities during the course of the game where a running back ends up one-on-one with a tackler. You can now actually quantify it. How much does a running back break? It's a really interesting stat, and I think it's certainly telling of the Bengals last year with how much they were getting out of Gio compared to how much you were getting out of Ben Jarvis, because what we would hear from our side, from the coaches a lot, was you can't look at much because the yards per carry were obviously significantly different between the two. So you can't look at much of that because sometimes it seemed like every time Benny would get the ball, it would get blocked up. And then every time Gio would get the ball, something would happen to be open or whatever. Well, this is the way of sort of taking that conjecture out of it and saying, no, here's the numbers. Here's how many times they were handed the ball and how many times they were able to make more out of it than was there or make a guy miss, you know, and whatever your method is to do that. So I think it's a good way for everybody to really understand what's really happening and maybe even feed through the coaches' lies that we get fed so often.
Yeah, I think that's where the grades come in too, because like I said, you can take any of our individual stats and you can spin a story. But when you look at the grades too, that'll take into account, well, there really was nothing there. You know, Kyle Cook got beat at the snap. Kevin Zeitler, whoever it is, got beat at the snap. And you know, Benny got dropped for a 5-yard loss right away. There's nothing he could do about it. Or like that Geno Atkins set on Tom Brady, where they did the play action where they tried to shift the whole line down the field, and Geno just beat the guy. He got upfield too quick for the guy to get hands on him. He sacked Tom Brady by the time he turned around. That's not a play that's going to hurt Tom Brady. Or similarly, that's not a play that's going to hurt Ben Jarvis Green-Ellis, because it's something they did wrong. But if the guy that got beat on the line, he's going to get a negative mark for that. And that's where I know you said the grades aren't the be-all, end-all, but that is go back to in the end, because I know how the grades are compiled. And like I said, before I saw the guts of it, there are a lot of times I was like, that doesn't really add up to my eye test. But then, you know, I would look at individual plays and try to figure out, you know, where's what I'm really questioning here. And I find that, again, more often than not, I agreed with it. So the grades are always where I end up going back to in the end to kind of see how the narrative might fit together, especially on a grade-by-grade basis. And something that I can do that, you know, the general public can't do is looking at a play-by-play basis as well.
Yeah.
But one other, you know, you're talking about individual stats that can really distill a skill. You're right. I think elusive rating is one of those where you can get to the core of how good is this running back at creating for himself. And one of them that's great for wide receivers and more people are tracking now is the drop rate. And we take then catchable passes, or we take receptions and drops, and we come up with the drop rate. And, you know, like you would expect, Larry Fitzgerald is at the top of the league in drop rate. He dropped one pass on 83 catchable balls last year. And unfortunately, A.J. Green dropped 10% of his passes last year, which isn't bad. It's more average. He's in the same category there as Dez Bryant and Calvin Johnson and Julian Edelman, all really high-volume guys. Pierre Garçon was a little bit better at almost 9%. So it's interesting to see these numbers, but then you have to put them in context, too. And when you look at the guys that had, you know, over 150 targets, only Antonio Brown had a drop rate below 7%, and a lot of his passes were really short. So Alshon Jeffery's another one, actually. He had a great year, 140 targets and only 5 drops, and we saw balls just stick to his hands in tight spots on the stretch last year, and that was pretty crazy to watch. But that's another good stat out there that really can distill an individual skill that, you know, we really think that if you drop a catchable pass, that's one of the more harshly graded aspects pretty typically for wide receivers. So drops are pretty damning, and that's one of the reasons I really like that number.
Yeah, it really is a great, because, you know, at the end of the day, you either caught the ball or you didn't, and there's really not a whole lot of way for people to debate in or around that stat. I mean, it's pretty much right on. And the fact is, when we talk about, man, how did A.J. Green end up with, let's see, where did A.J. Green ended up with a 13.2 overall? You say, well, how did that happen? Well, you look at his drops, you know, and that's, you say that's why he didn't end up with his numbers being amongst the top 5 or 10 in the league, because you guys grade those drops pretty harshly, and he had quite a few of them, more so than you would certainly expect out of a guy who's known for catching the ball. Well, I want to delve deeper into the Bengals specifically now, so people can kind of get a feel for what the numbers say about the Bengals compared to what people traditionally think about them. And I want to throw out a few players for you, and you can tell me that players that I think have interesting analysis on your site. Let's start with one that's relevant right now, which was just this week. The Bengals extend Domantas Pekka, defensive tackle, 2 years. He's now locked in through 2016. Pro Football Focus has not been driving the Domantas Pekka bandwagon really for the last 5 years. Had him as a negative grade every year. Had him as his worst season ever last year, as the worst graded defender on the entire Bengals defense. What did you see last year from Pekka, and what was going on that moved him down so low in your eyes?
Yeah, Pekka's an interesting one, and that's one that I've kind of struggled to figure out myself. But then when I actually turn it on and watch him, there are some times that I'm sympathetic towards what he faces, and then there are some times that I just kind of wonder if he actually is really doing what the coaches ask of him. Clearly, they love him in Cincinnati. He's got a great personality. He's a fan favorite. They just extended him for 2 more years, and we'll wait to see the terms of the contract, but that seems like a gesture that they like what he's doing in Cincinnati. And you've got to think that comes from their evaluation of him as a player on the football field. But when you look at our numbers, you know, he had 703 snaps last year, and he's not known as a pass rusher, but he only had 15 pressures all year. You know, people will say, oh, we have 4 sacks, and, you know, you go back and you look at those sacks, and it's not because he's firing off the ball or shoving guys aside and getting to the quarterback really quickly. He's kind of doing his job and grinding out, and somebody will flush the quarterback, or a play will break down and he'll clean it up. And that was a variety of his sacks. And in the running game, this is where I was sometimes sympathetic, because Pekka was a target of a lot of double teams. And I'm not sure really how that really plays itself out in the grades. It could just be teams are double teaming him because he doesn't know how to beat double teams. And if you can't beat double teams, you know, yeah, it's hard, but there are guys that have their strategies or ways to cope with beating a double team. So he didn't really show up very well in the run defense game either. You know, he had 25 stops on the year. That includes, that doesn't just include running plays, but it's tough with Pekka. He just doesn't seem to move guys. He occupies space. He occupies blockers, but that doesn't necessarily reflect itself well in our ratings. And when he does get pushed around or misses a tackle, then that's going to get a negative mark. And when there aren't very many positive plays for him to hang his hat on, it's tough from a grading perspective. And this is one of those where I kind of see what you're saying about the grade not being the end-all, be-all. While I will tout that as the best number to really boil it down to, I do acknowledge that with nose tackles like Pekka in a 4-3, maybe there's something lost there, but that being said, he's getting graded the same way as all the other guys in the same situation. So he's not some that other guys are.
And you would think that he would be more the beneficiary due to playing next to Geno Atkins, Michael Johnson, and Carlos Dunlap, but we're not. You're not seeing as much. You know, as far as that on the field goes, and I kind of wrote a little bit about this today. It has to at a certain point for teams, it has to go beyond the field and the numbers. I think the biggest reason that Pecco is back is because of the leadership that he brings and the signal it would send to the rest of the team if they were to let him, I think would be a poor one to the younger guys, because this team's all about rewarding people that play as team players and are on and off the field producing. Now, that's reason for it. The reason against it would be everything that you're talking about, that, hey, on the field, he's not exactly been a game changer or a playmaker out there. But, hey, he's also started every game for three straight years for defense, right in the top 10. So it can't all be bad, right? he's a really interesting case study, I thought. Another one I want to go into, Jermaine Gresham. Which I'm sort of, I don't know, it seems like I'm picking on players that you guys have picked on. I will go to the positive side at some point, but he has not been a favorite of PFF either. He's probably the Pecco equivalent on offense. Most of it seems to be you guys aren't a fan of Gresham, and it comes a lot in pass blocking. We get into this debate with the coaches because we see your guys' grades on his pass blocking, on his run and pass blocking, they tell us they love him as a blocker and think he's one of the best in the league. Your numbers wouldn't dictate that. What do you see with Gresham that puts you on the side where you see you view him as a liability in blocking in particular?
Just on a play-to-play basis, I remember that very vividly when Gruden came out and said, we think he's one of the best blockers in the league. It was Gruden, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember reading that, and when he said that, I went back and I watched a bunch of Gresham run-blocking plays. And the guy, he just sometimes gets lost in run-blocking. He'll end up lunging and missing. He'll just get beat inside and then not be able to actually move his guy off the ball. And in Gresham's defense, there aren't very many tight ends that are very good blockers anymore in the NFL. I think we only have one guy with a substantially positive run blocking grade at tight end, and that was
Ben Hartsock.
Right. And yep, Ben Hartsock and Brent Celek, you know, graded out okay in run blocking. He was one of just a couple guys with, you know, a significantly positive run blocking score that also had a positive pass blocking score. But those guys are few and far between, and they didn't, for the most part, take nearly as many snaps as Gresham's 909. So, yeah, I mean, with the run blocking, it's just if you watch him, and I did this, if you really just watch him on a play-to-play basis, more often than not, he's coming up empty in the run blocking game, and that's tough to see because he's a ridiculously strong individual, and then the plays that he does show up and he gets a block, he'll take 10 yards down the field and throw him out of bounds at the end of it. And you know he can do it. And it's just you don't see a play to play. And that's got to be the frustrating thing with Gresham. The other thing that really hurts Gresham is the penalties. He had 10 penalties last year, which is the league lead for an offensive player. The drops weren't as bad last year, but they reared their head toward the end of the year. And the fumbles actually were really kind of rough. He had 3 fumbles last year. He didn't have as many drops. You know, he only had a couple drops, actually, so I take that back. He had 3 drops last year, but the 3 fumbles really hurt him in the passing game, too. And, again, here's a place where he flashes really well sometimes, you know, just run over guys on occasion, and he really did that. When it was a cornerback trying to tackle Gresham, it generally didn't go very well for Segner back. But when it's a linebacker or a safety, he hasn't shown the agility to make those guys miss, and he tries to run them over. Maybe he falls forward for a couple of yards, but it's not terribly impressive in the grading when you catch, you know, a 5-yard hitch and you fall forward for 2 more yards. That's an important football play, but you know you're not going to get a huge grade for it. You'll get a positive grade for that sort of play, but that's one of the easier plays for an offense to execute, which is actually one of the problems with Andy Dalton when you look at our grading, but I don't know if you even want to touch Dalton right now.
Well, you know what? You're a pro at this media stuff because you just led my perfect segue in exactly to go with two next. Because it would be unfortunate, and I think because our readers, our listeners, everyone, they just can't get enough of this guy, you know, and understandably so. It's the most important position in sports, and it's certainly the most relevant position with the organization right now. I was in Orlando, obviously, this past week, and down there spoke with Mike Brown, spoke with Marvin Lewis, and found it to be very, very interesting some of the things that they had to say about Andy Dalton, specifically that he is their number one priority right now, and they feel like they need to get his extension taken care of, and they want it to happen ASAP, sooner rather than later. And Mike Brown had more reservations, probably. He was more focused on making sure that they get a good deal for Andy Dalton. Marvin Lewis just wants to see it done. And what I want to do is I want to bring in the quote from Mike, and then I'm going to follow that up with the quote from a couple quotes from Marvin talking about Andy Dalton and their opinion on his contract situation and what they'd like to see. So here's Mike Brown, followed by Marvin Lewis, talking about Andy Dalton and where he's at.
I find the CBA is starting to kind of play itself out a little bit now, the one that for a few years ago was agreed to. And you're seeing a lot of this money being spent in different ways. Obviously, the quarterback being the most important position, you're seeing these big numbers. Quarterbacks are just going to continue to get paid more. It seems like the teams are so willing to pay them so much more. Is it safer to lock in quarterbacks early before those numbers continue to jump up? I guess in your situation with Dalton, is there an inherent risk in allowing quarterbacks in particular to hit the market because so teams are willing to spend such huge amounts of money on to get a quarterback, and so many teams have to have one?
Oh, the player market is something that always is surprising. Why the prices are so high is hard to know for sure. You look backwards, and there have been more bad deals than there have been good deals from a club's perspective. That doesn't mean there haven't been some good deals, there have. But more often than not, you don't win overpaying a guy. With quarterbacks, there's another dilemma. With a fixed cap, there's a certain amount of money and no more. And if you allocate that on a quarterback, then you have less to hand out to everybody else, and it can cause attrition. We're going through a difficult time right now because we are trying to work through a deal with Andy. We're trying to hold back enough money in the cap to do that, and yet we don't know what that is. So what do we do? Do we risk and sign guys and then find out we don't have enough to do him? Or do we risk and hold back enough to make sure we can get him done, but maybe lose a guy or two? And that's what happened to us already this year. When you go forward in this league, it is not clear which is the better way to go. Do you have a high-priced quarterback and less elsewhere? Or do you try to have as many guys as you can have and maybe a quarterback that's young and not so highly paid? Seattle is an example. of that. In fact, if you look at the statistics, it's rather surprising how few quarterbacks that were old in recent years, old being, say, 31 and older, over 30, have won the Super Bowl. They've gotten there, but they haven't won it. And I don't know, is a better formula go with the younger guy and spread the money around and a solid team? But that's a dilemma for us, and we're trying to work through it. It is slow going, and I can't predict when we're going to get the matter resolved.
Yeah. Is it fair to say, I guess, that that's sort of the basis of where you have to start your entire offseason, you know, who you're going to pay, how you're going to pay, and it has to start with the biggest chip in quarterbacks just are. Is that fair to say? I guess you have to get that figured out before you can really go forward with too much anything else.
It is a restriction on what you do.
Right, yeah.
We're hopeful that we feel like we have a great young player in Andy. We're hopeful we can get a deal done that works, and Andy can continue. He can put it behind him. He can get back focused on football. He doesn't have to go into the season and worry about this contract thing being one of the, I mean, every week somebody's going to ask him a question, you know, and then it gets to there, and, you know, then are you franchised? You know, all those things that come into play later on. Let's get it behind us. Let's get something that works for everyone, enables us to keep tackles in front of you, receivers on the outside, guys on the other side of the football. So it works for everyone.
Do you think he gets that, Marv? Do you think he gets this?
I think he gets it.
That's part of a big picture deal.
I think he gets it, but you know, at some point you gotta push everyone else to get it. You know, hey, this is what's best for me long term. You know, and so I'm not maimed. You know, you know, if you can make this much money for this many years as opposed to this much money for 2 years because you're maimed, you know what I mean? It's you know, and you see it. I mean, you look at the quarterbacks that keep changing teams, and they're guys that got thrown in as young guys, and they weren't protected. I mean, there's one on the street right now. And, you know, I mean, when you're not protected at that position as a young player, you start seeing ghosts, you know. And we've been good to protect our young player at that spot, you know, time and time again, so that he can, you know, perform his job and keep prospering.
So it sounds like you're completely sold. Andy's the guy.
Oh, yes.
Going forward. Why is that? Why?
Because he's done what most people haven't ever done. He's taken a team to the playoffs 3 years in a row from the rookie on, and continues to ascend, you know, and get better.
What about his performances in the playoffs?
Well, we lost the football game, and the quarterback gets to blame when you lose. But we didn't cover people on third down. We fumbled the football. Andy had a fumble. We didn't protect Andy, you know. So we as coaches got to do a better job. We all lost.
So we hear from Mike and we hear from Marvin, and it's clear that this is about trying to get a deal done that allows them to pay the other guys that they want to pay, because the possibility they're not really willing to accept the possibility that they would have to pay Andy Dalton on the high end of what his market value is, which would come if he had a great year and finally let the Bengals to a playoff win, and now all of a sudden you're looking at Cutler money or Stafford money or whatever you're talking about. You're looking at probably somewhere, you're looking at, you know, 17, 18 million a year, and somewhere from 20 to 50 million guaranteed or whatever. You know, quarterback money is ridiculous, and it'll only get worse as the salary cap numbers go up. So they feel like they can get him at a deal now, and it sounded to me like a lot like a coach really who lives year to year in the NFL, as you have to, wanting to get this year set for himself. He knows Dalton's going to be his quarterback. He should come out. He should support him. He should say, Andy Dalton's my guy, because that's his best chance of winning this year. Here's all you can really think of in the NFL. Now, to bring the statistical aspect of this into play, Andy Dalton is, I mean, he is, by the numbers, and I think most people's eye test as well, the epitome of the average quarterback. What do you see, what do the numbers say that sticks out to you the most about Andy Dalton that would give you reason to believe one way or the other that he is the guy that can do it, or is emerging, or any of those?
Yeah, great question. I want to start with a couple non-analytic comments to just add to the speculation and the fire with Andy Dalton. And there, it was really interesting to hear Mike Brown's comments. And with Marvin Lewis, that's what he said for most extensions. I think he said the same thing about Palmer. He said that about extensions in the past. He's, with contracts, we just want to get him in here. That's all he really ever says, I think. And with Brown, the comments are really interesting because they come on the heels of the comments about Kaepernick. And he is the GM of the team. And fans, I think these days, can forget that. You know, a lot of people, sometimes myself included, think or don't know who's calling the shots. So that said, I think that take is very interesting when you put those comments in context. From a statistical perspective, Dalton, he works out to be pretty average, which is interesting. You know, his regular season grade actually finally finished in the positive for the first time in his young NFL career. And that's great. From a high level 16 game perspective, he was right just above average in our grading system. Which fits the narrative. But if you look at it game to game, he's anything but, right? He starts out the year with a solid showing in Chicago. He comes back and he struggles against Pittsburgh as sometimes in the past, and struggles against, you know, Green Bay, has an off game against Cleveland. Then he comes out a couple weeks later, has one of the best games of his career against New York Jets. You think, oh, that's the best we're going to see from Dalton. He comes out and they had a tough time in Miami. He had a worse game against Baltimore. He had a couple more tough games in Cleveland and San Diego. Then he comes out against Indianapolis and he does even better than he did against the Jets. And that included, you know, some nice work in the running game. Has a better than usual game for him anyway against Pittsburgh. And then against Minnesota, who, you know, laughing stock a little bit in the secondary at that point in the season, and just puts up, you know, even better numbers. His best passing numbers by far. His best game of his career. 2 weeks later against San Diego, the team that, you know, the Bengals had no major issue with in week 13 at San Diego, and just has his worst game of the season. And I think it was the worst game of his career, according to our grades.
According to your grades, yeah.
And it's just the up and down with him is incredible. And when you look at the games where he played well, it starts to make some sense. He played very well against some bad secondaries and then randomly Indianapolis. The Indianapolis game was one that, going into that week, I remember feeling pretty confident, like the Bengals had nothing to really worry about with Indy, even though Andrew Luck is on that football team and, you know, they did a number on Peyton Manning a few weeks prior. I, for some reason, thought that matchup would go fine, and it did. The Bengals kept Dalton upright, and it was a great game for him. He had time to find his guys, and Vontae Davis didn't have a great game. And the other game, so Minnesota, terrible secondary. The Jets in Week 8, their defensive line is very, very good at controlling the running game, but their secondary at that point in the season wasn't playing well. Cromartie was playing really bad at that point in the season. They benched the rookie from Alabama, whose name is escaping me. Help me here. Milner.
Yeah, Dee Milner.
He got benched in the middle of the game. And Dalton, of course, you know, he puts up great numbers. Chicago, transition year for that defense. Early in the year, not playing great on the defensive side of the ball. So when you look at the games where he actually played well, it's not against the best defenses in the league. And you look at the games where he played poorly, and it's against the fierce pass rush that Miami and Baltimore bring to the table. And then you look at the playoff game, and I wrote about this when I wrote the preview for the game. That team that Cincinnati faced in the wild card game was very different from the team they played in week 13 with guys coming back from injury, but he didn't play that well against them in week 13 either. And that's at the time, when I was writing the Week 13 preview, I was thinking to myself, if Andy Dalton is going to get off the schneid, he'll do it against the secondary. It was our worst graded pass defense at the time in the league. So he's an enigma to figure out when you look at his up and downs throughout there, but it seems like he maybe plays tight against better defenses or something like that, or maybe it's just the teams that are better on defense can take it away.
Yeah, I think one stat that you and I've referenced a few times is the accuracy percentage under pressure. And I think we've seen this play out where we often reference how Andy Dalton struggles with pressure, which has been okay because the Bengals' offensive line has been amongst the best in football at keeping pressure off of the quarterback. But he, more than most quarterbacks, has really struggled with trying to deal well with pressure and make plays out of it. He ranks 23rd in your accuracy percentage when under pressure. And that's probably one of the kindest stats when it comes to pressure with him. It just seems like, and that's why I think your stats do a really good job of pulling that out. When he's had time to sit back there and pick apart a defense, he really can do it. But as the situation gets more adverse, that's when you tend to see the awful, the bad Andy decisions that have happened a lot. And it's, you know, that's where you get concerned, because at a certain point in time, you're going to have to deal with that, and the best quarterbacks in the league are the ones that deal with that well. And whether it be pressure in game or pressure generally around a big game, the lack of ability to deal with that is that somebody that you are willing to plop down multiple, you know, double digit millions of dollars on at the most important position. That's really the question.
And it's extra tricky, right, because you've got Dalton is the first quarterback drafted under the new CBA to come up for an extension, and Cam Newton has the benefit of the transition tag that Mike Brown talked about with AJ
right.
Green. And the one area that Andy Dalton did improve on pressure last year is that he did better at avoiding sacks when he was under pressure. He took a sack when he was under pressure 18% of the time last year, which is not too bad. It might be better than average against 29% of the time last year when he was under pressure, which was worse than the league. So that is a place where he went from, you know, really, really tough, like taking a sack a lot of the time when he is under pressure, even though he's not under pressure that often, to now doing a better job of at least getting rid of the ball or not taking the sack when he's under pressure. So,
that's one thing, you know, when you're talking about Dalton, that I think a lot of people forget, is when the team and the coaches have given him an off season and sat down and had a point of emphasis, he's typically done a nice job of improving in that area. Now, the last year we talked a lot about deep ball percentage. Well, your numbers bear out that he was exponentially better in connecting, throwing the ball down the field last year. People don't really talk too much about that anymore. The same way with throwing the ball away and not taking sacks. They take a huge number of sacks previous year. He's a lot better this last year at not allowing that to happen. This year, the point of emphasis is going to be avoiding so many of the interceptions. Now, I think a lot of that will be game plan, where they'll try to be much safer with Dalton and what they do, and not as much of the, you know, spread, throw it around thing that Jay Gruden had going on, a little bit more that probably fits a running game safe style that will keep Dalton from turning the ball over. If he can do that, I mean, I think you're okay with Andy Dalton. I mean, I think the numbers would change dramatically if you could do away with so many of the interceptions. But the question is, I mean, I don't know how much you see that happening.
I think the other point of emphasis with Dalton needs to be, you're right, it's interceptions, but it's really in the short part of the field where that really comes back to bite him, because the majority of his passes are coming in the short part of the field, the behind the line of scrimmage to 9 yards down the field, and you just cannot make mistakes in that area. You can't. You can't make mistakes on easy throws, and he threw 8 interceptions on passes shorter than 9 yards last year. You can't do that. You know, if you throw up the deep ball and it gets picked off, most fans are going to be able to flip that. You know, you throw a ball that bounces off Muhammad Sanu's hands in the middle of the field, and it falls into a defender's hands, you're not going to get mad at Dalton. And in the intermediate part of the field, he wasn't bad. It was in the middle of the field. He threw five picks in the middle of the field in the intermediate zone. So it's definitely the interceptions and it's the decisions in a lot of cases that lead to those picks. And you know, ball placement is part of the issue, and so too is decision making, especially on those outs and the hitches where he'd either be late. You know, he'd hesitate and be hurt. He just wouldn't put the ball out there properly. Or, you know, the most common criticism that I think I hear is he makes predetermined reads. And I don't know how much of that is Dalton versus how much of that was the offense, the West Coast style that he was playing in. So I'm curious to see what Hugh Jackson is going to do. He's made it to say we're going to run the ball more, which I think will benefit Dalton. You know, he had the ninth most dropbacks in football last year. In the company of Andrew Luck and Ben Roethlisberger. And meanwhile, you have a guy like Philip Rivers or Tony Romo who are, you know, for all the grief Tony Romo takes, better passers than Dalton, at least to this point in his career, with 50 less dropbacks, you know, to 70 less dropbacks or 62 less dropbacks. So taking some of that pressure off Dalton, getting the running game going could help too, but then you get a little bit concerned with the makeup of the Bengals offensive line being pass protection oriented. And it'll be interesting to see how Jackson balances the carries between Gio, Ben Jarvis, and Rex Burkhead or whoever else they've got back there next year.
Yeah, one thing you were saying, I think the interesting numbers aspect of this, you talk about 9 of his 20 interceptions coming 9 yards and closer in. I mean, if you're Hugh Jackson, you're trying to have safer, shorter throws, if that's really the idea, you could be sort of dragging yourself down to the lion's den a little bit. If that's where the guy's been having his problems and you're going to do more of those now, you better make sure you fix that decision-making. And I don't know that that's something that is that easily fixed. So maybe that could actually be working against them if they try to do that. An interesting thing to keep an eye on when next year starts is if that is the case, are you really just kind of feeding him into his weakness? You know, an interesting thing to think about. Also, you were talking about dropbacks. Where they want to get Andy Dalton, right? You had total dropbacks last year. Colin Kaepernick and Russell Wilson were ranked 20th and 21st. Colin Kaepernick with 504. Russell Wilson with 502 dropbacks. That's where they want Andy Dalton to be, not all the way up at 640 dropbacks. They want the team to be fashioned the way that San Francisco and Seattle do, which would make sense, and it wouldn't put as much of the onus on winning and losing on the rapid highs and lows of Dalton that we just discussed. I think that's the idea behind the new theory, and we'll see if that plays out. And we'll see if Andy Dalton's career salary will be hinging on whether it does play out well or not. It's a really interesting predicament, and one that if you continue reading, come back to say.com, keep picking up the paper, keep listening to these podcasts, we will overanalyze beyond belief because that's what we do, because he's the quarterback and that's all everybody wants to talk about. And it's really, until they get this thing figured out, everyone else hangs in limbo. A.J. Green, Vontaze Burfict, insert names here that they want to extend, all are waiting to see if they're going to fill up so much of their cap space with quarterback cash this year. Well, Jake, I want to tell you thank you for joining. I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to talk football. So I know it's really hard for you to walk away from your day job and talk football numbers. I know that's something you hate doing.
Yeah, big sacrifice for me today.
So you've sacrificed now. You've given me your time. I want to give back to you because as people know that listen to Scribe Session, that love it religiously, we always go out with some music. And I don't know if you have anything in mind or you have some walkout music that you'd like people to go home humming here today. If you want me to track down a good numbers song for you or if you've got something in mind, what do you want the people to feel as you go out the door?
You know, I earlier mentioned Happy by Pharrell, and I know it's the number one song on the R&B Billboard Top 40 or whatever it is, but I think people deserve to hear that and feel happy going into their...
People do deserve to feel happy, although I'm a little concerned about this song being overplayed. It's in this stupid Oasis commercial with P. Diddy now, and I'm not happy about that because...
But isn't that ironic that it's going to
P. Diddy? Shove it down our throats. It's going to get shoved down our throats, and next thing you know, this great song that does currently make me feel happy will now make me feel frustrated that it's overplayed, and I don't like that. But for the sake of this, it is your choice. I want to give back to you. We can. Let's bring in Happy and a little Pharrell for people to go out with. So thanks, Jake, again. I really appreciate taking time to chat with me. Love talking analytics, and everybody keep an eye out. I'll be referencing Pro Football Focus all the time and working with Jake plenty more as we go forward this offseason. Keep an eye out for bestofsanity.com. Of course, the podcast is going to keep coming to you. We're hoping through the offseason every other week to bring you a new person and talk about whatever's going on. And there's obviously plenty going on because the NFL never stops. Draft's only 5 weeks away, so we'll be hitting that pretty soon. Jake, thank you again. Thank you, Pharrell. And we will see you next time on Scratch Session. Give me all you got and don't hold me back. Well, I should probably warn you, I'll be just fine. No offense to you, who don't waste your time. Here's why. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like the room is on the roof. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you know what happiness is to you. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do. Bring me down, can't let me. Bring me down, the love is too hard. Bring me down, can't let me. Bring me down, I said. Bring me down, can't let me. Bring me down, the love is too hard. Bring me down, can't let me. Bring me down, I said. Clap along if you feel like the room is on the roof. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth.
Clap along if you feel like a room is out of room.